given Hinton and Under sufficient clarity to redraft, so that the next time we meet, we can then look at a redraft of the bill. So we would be going on till as late as we can tonight. Mario, who are you looking for? Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought you were looking at someone in particular. I don't know what's happening with lunch and supper, but all that will probably be revealed later. I've asked for a meeting with Vanele Mene at lunchtime. We're joined by JB Sibanyoni, who's most welcome, who I'm not quite sure whether he intended to be here, but he is here, and his presence is really valued. So just to welcome JB. Basically, then, the story so far is we've dealt with specific aspects in the bill. We've then had the intention would be to go through the bill clause by clause. We've had the update of the summary of submissions document, which would be assumed that everybody has read. We won't read them again, but when we go through clause by clause, Henken and Under can refer us, or anyone else for that matter, can refer us to any submissions that they feel may be relevant. A lot of the submissions seem to have not understood the bill that correctly. We had asked, just as far as the issue of how to deal with the principles, we had asked Henken and Ananda to do a redraft of those sections, and that's been tabled now. I think Henken and Ananda can speak to them. There were then also submissions on the exclusion of it's part of annexes to the summary of submissions on the exclusion of for exclusive journalistic purposes and unsolicited emails, and then some other supporting documents from comparative legislation. So I what I'm proposing then is that we start with a presentation from Henk and Ananda, discuss that, and then start going through the bill clause by clause. There is also an issue that Ms. Smuts and I think sort of discussed, but just to put it on the table up front, and Dean, correct me if I'm wrong, and that would be we had discussed the issue of the bill being principle-based rather than rules-based, and the general agreement with that. That it would be a broad set of rules, that it would be up to the regulator, in a sense, to adjudicate. And as the bill stands at the moment, the offences are relating to not complying with things that the regulator does. The question would be, should there not be certain categories of personal information which we should make an offence? That you don't have to actually go to the regulator for a determination. That it's so blatantly obvious that it is an offence, that the conduct should be criminalised. And the one category that falls into that, there may be others, but the most obvious category would be the dissemination of information relating to personal bank accounts, personal banking details. That is not publicly available, it's not freely available, but Ms. Smuts, for example, had written an article which you may have seen referring to some of the stuff in the consumer columns in the media relating to problems that occurred then, occurred with information relating to people's bank accounts being sold and therefore those accounts effectively being deducted without that person's authority. So that's a question which we can also, I'm putting it on the table. It's not so much for discussion now. I mean, we could discuss it now, but I'm raising it for consideration. We can see how we then factor it in, but I just wanted to mainly, I think, give advance notice that that's a topic to discuss as well. Maybe it would be better not to discuss it now to give everybody time to think about it. Mario.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a fast thinker, so I had the time I needed.
Mario, just on that, is everybody else? So what I'm saying is let's not discuss.
Well, I'm sorry. Let me.
Okay.
You know, things of deciding for others what others want to discuss. Let me approach you on the guidance you're giving to the meeting. In terms of process, and that's what I'm approaching you on. I think that the point you're raising is preliminary. I would like for us to have a preliminary discussion on exactly the discussion between you and the Honorable Matt, to tease out exactly what it means so that there is a clear, unpacked understanding of what it means to have a bill which is principally, which is given by principles and not by rules. I can unpack that in my mind in three or four different options. And the difficulty I have is that until there is clarity on what we want into the details, and if I may, Mr. Chairman, take it a little further, until there is clarity about what you want into details, the mandate which is given to the drafter, if it is fudgy, gets translated into a rehashing of exactly the same content, which is basically what we have in front of us. And it is not their fault. I mean, I'm talking about the preliminary section. They've reorganized the material with an explanation, which one can debate whether or not it adds value, adds clarity, or detracts value and clarity. But I think that the fault lies in exactly as not having unpacked in details, and you, Mr. Chairman, not having clarified, at least to my understanding, exactly how you would want the relationship between principles guiding the activity of the regulators and norms and rules directed to the populace to work.
I don't know what the views of Dean and JB are. What I would suggest is, I don't think there's any problem with having a discussion on it early on, but we should start, though, with the input by Henk and Ananda on the document that they've just tabled, and then we proceed with the question of whether we have specific crimes. JB?
Okay, I will be for the view that maybe if that proceeds and listen to the input by Henk.
Henk and Ananda, I don't know who's doing the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, apologies. I indicated that it is a working document, and I incorrectly dated it at the top left-hand side of half the page. I'm not going to refer you to the first two pages. That's something that we can just have a look at a later stage. I just thought it wise to keep the index with the relevant provisions, and that was mainly sort of just as a drafting note for myself to remember to bring the index in line as we proceed with the document. On the second page, Mr. Chair, what we termed as a roadmap in the previous meeting, we attempted to give meaning to that to the extent that we would like to, in this application clause 3, attempt to give a general overview of the important aspects of the bill. I think what we would try to do was not to create substantive provisions here. That's always the possibility when one starts with something like this. But, however, subclause 1 was amended in view of the discussion that took place at the previous meeting, where there was an indication that as far as jurisdictional aspects are concerned, the clause was a bit cluttered. So what we tried to do there is to provide a better differentiation between paragraphs, subparagraphs A and B, So the first important thing is then, of course, that the Act will apply to the processing of personal information entered in a record by or for a responsible party, A, where the responsible party is domiciled in the Republic or not domiciled in the Republic but makes use of automated or non-automated means that are situated in the Republic unless those means are used only to transfer personal information to the Republic. And then B, by making use of automated or non-automated means, provided that when the recorded personal information is processed by non-automated means, it forms part of the filing system or intended to form part thereof. Before we step off this one, Mr. Chair, I would just like to draw your attention to two footnotes. I don't think it's necessary to discuss that now, but the question has just been raised whether it wouldn't add value to define those terms. So, subclause 1 was actually our clause 3 in the bill in total. Subclauses 2 to 7 aims to assist us with a roadmap. Subclause 2 brings the principles within the roadmap by referring to the relevant sections. You will recall that that was the request to see whether we could be, whether we would be able to do something about this whole issue that bothers the committee. So subclause 2 then provides that the conditions for lawful processing of personal information by or for responsible party are subject to subsection 3 reflected in the following general information protection principles. And then we stipulate them and we refer to the relevant sections. The provision is therefore subject to the provisions of subsection 3. There's two important aspects when one look at the processing of personal information that you must immediately take into consideration, and that is that there are exclusions in terms of section 4, and then also the regulator may grant exemptions from one or more of the principles concerned in relation to the processing of personal information. So subclause 2, the gist thereof is straightforward, but then the provisions are also subject to subsection 3. And subsection 3 then indicates to us the principles referred to in subsection 2 are not applicable to the processing of personal information to the extent that such processing is excluded in terms of section 4 from the operation of the Act, or then the regulator has granted an exemption in terms of Chapter 4 from one or more of the principles concerned in relation to such processing. Subclause 4 aims to provide us with an indication of what the codes of conduct are actually all about. And maybe we could just, once again, just read it quickly. Sections 57 to 65 provide for the development in appropriate circumstances of codes of conduct for purposes of clarifying how the information protection principles referred to in subsection 2 and the requirements referred to in subsection 5 are to be applied or are to be complied with within a particular sector. So the clause aims to give us an indication that the codes are there to supplement the general provisions of our principles in order to clarify the application thereof in a specific sector. Subclause 5 and 6 deal then with the processing of special personal information. Subclause 5 provides that the additional requirements for the lawful processing of special personal information by or for a responsible party are in addition to the principles referred to in subsection 2. I think that's important, Mr. Chair, that one can just note that when special personal information is processed, one shouldn't lose the idea that you will have to still comply with all the provisions referred to in Part A of that chapter. Subclause 6 then provides us the principles that refer to in subsection 2, so that is the general information protection principle, and the additional requirements referred to in subsection 5 are not applicable to the processing of personal information, and then once again, if such processing is excluded from the operation of the Act in terms of section 4, or then if the regulator has granted an exemption. So to a certain extent, one could, well, 5 and 6 is, in a drafting sense, very similar to 2 and 3, but we thought that it might be useful to keep the two separate from each other, and then possibly just at this point, I would also like to indicate that it might be that we would like to possibly propose that we just shift the order, because subclauses 5 and 6 should, strictly speaking, precede subclause 4. However, that's something technical that we can look at a later stage. And then the final subclause, Mr. Chair, is the provisions dealing with direct marketing. We also thought that it might be useful to also indicate that in our roadmap, because that is also a tricky area. Subclause 7 therefore provides that the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information by or for a responsible party for the purposes of direct marketing are then reflected in the principles referred to in subsection 2, and then also insofar as marketing by means of unsolicited electronic communications are concerned, the provisions of section 66. Apologies. Mr. Chair, with regard to the next clause, the exclusions clause, clause 4, you will recall, first of all, that our first proposed amendment is in clause 4C, where we indicated that we feel that the use of the term state is incorrect and that it should be replaced with public body. So the proposed amendment is there. The remainder of the options that you see there relate to the journalists. So you will find the first paragraph D that you encounter there is the paragraph as reflected in the bill itself. Then we have an option 1 and an option 2. Option 2 is the one that aims to provide for an exclusion in toto. The first and the third options are very similar to the extent that you will recall, Chair, that the question was raised on a few occasions what adequate safeguards really mean, and that we should try and further define or describe that. So option one is merely the provision as it is reflected, or should be reflected then in the clause itself, but we were also requested to look at a separate clause. It's now loosely based on the Australian example, and that is the proposed new clause 4A. I don't know whether you need me to go into too much detail at this stage.
Wouldn't it be better to take one bite at a time, at least if something is preliminary to others? Because I really think that if we have a discussion on the application of the Act, depending on whatever direction you give us on that, some of the other issues will be affected by it. And I would like to approach on Section 1, if I may.
I think Henk has covered it. I mean, the journalistic exclusion is specific, and then obviously the rest is the changes you've made on the regulator. But do they relate to the overall structure? Not really. No.
Chair, that is what I wanted to propose at this stage, is maybe just for the committee to note that there is proposed amendments to Chapter 5. But there are also many questions being raised, so it will require discussion, but I think we would prefer maybe to receive your guidance.
Let's discuss then the so-called roadmap. Mario?
My earlier comments were based on a preliminary reading of this section, which we obviously received on... we just received now. So my... I don't know whether I've missed some nuisance, but the... My question to Hank, and it's a rhetorical question, is there anything new in this roadmap from a legislative viewpoint, from a normative viewpoint? Thank you very much. And it seems to me that the answer is no, and it shouldn't be no, with the exception of 3A and 6, sorry, 3B and 6B. There is something new, where the regulator, if I read it correctly, could make some of the provisions not applicable to the citizenry. Now, setting aside the concerns of constitutionality, of giving an organ of state the power to make certain provisions of the statute not applicable or exempt people from the application of the law, that addresses the issue that we've been struggling with. Who does this law, who does this act apply? What is the scope of application? And the answer in here is applies to everyone, it's universal, but they can cut pieces out where it doesn't make sense. And we need to have, at least I do, Mr. Chairman, guidance on what exactly, where your minds are. Where your mind is. I mean, you sit there high on the strength of a 66% mandate from the people of South Africa. So at the end, it is, and this is a critical question. And you have, and I appreciate, I mean, and the privilege of having a mind is that you can change it. And you've been working with these crucial fundamental issues in your mind a few times, tasting the various options. But I think that we need to deal with this. Who do we want the act itself to apply to? And what is the relationship between the act and the codes? Because, and the codes. The codes? Yeah. Why am I looking, why are you looking at me in that tone of voice? Oh. Because once, if only the codes apply, and the act and the principles are guidance to the regulator for the issuance of the codes, and the codes are to be issued subject to the principles, then we've got one aspect. If the act applies to everyone and the codes supplement, then we've got the second aspect. If we go with this approach that the act applies to everyone and the codes supplement, but the regulator can carve out certain pieces, we've got the third one.
Did you want to come in?
Yeah, I want to come in on what Pink has put before us, but now just to respond to Mario. I remember saying to you a long time ago, because this is an unusual bill, that the only direct comparator I could think of was the BEE Act, remember, and its codes, and how the codes had in that case preceded the law. It was all the craziest exercise I've ever seen and is to this day. But I don't think that kind of difficulty translates to this bill. These are, and I'm thinking now as I speak, this sets the principles, makes conditions relevant to their application in order to make the thing lawful. It is unusual, but Mario, you find it in every democracy that you care to think of, and they all take exactly the same approach. So, you know, it's not unheard of. I think that we will have to address the problem you raise, and to what degree can the code depart. But it doesn't on the face of it seem to me so insuperable. I mean, you're going to apply it to a specific sector where certain operational characteristics apply. And I'm happy to think about it again when we get to the codes section. But I don't think that you are, I think you're suggesting that the codes will allow a complete departure from what is otherwise of general application.
Is that what I mean, I would like to hear
my understanding, and I thought we discussed it before. I don't know, sometimes you go to meetings, particularly in the rural areas, and people want you to repeat what you'd said so they can check whether there's any contradictions, and then get confident that, okay, no, you're definitely speaking the truth because you're saying the same thing. I don't know if that's what's happening. What's happening here? But my understanding is that the law applies to everybody and is of general application. It's principle based because of the problem of legislating for a sector that is perpetually in movement. So it would set out the principles that apply to the protection of personal information. You then set up the regulator to basically adjudicate where there are complaints. So we're not making offences in the bill. Where there's a problem, so this problem about this is so wide, it's impossible to implement. You're making the street seller in or the road seller on the way to Ulundi. I don't know if you met her during the constituency period, Dr. Ambrosini. I don't think so. No, you went to America, sorry. Okay, I'll stop sniping.
Who's going to protect me from the chair?
I'll stop sniping, I promise, okay. But basically, you know, so that it would be basically complaint activated. Those are the guidelines. Those are the principles to be followed. If they're not followed, you complain to the regulator. The regulator then corrects the damage by making an order that this should not happen. But there's not really any other specific new penalties provided for. With specific sectors, then the regulator is empowered to develop codes, which would have which would be in accordance with the broad principles, but would have greater specificity as to what can be done and what can't be done. So that's my understanding of which I think is still consistent with the overall original intention of the bill as introduced.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, may I restate what you said just to have clarity? Because I can live with what you said, but this is not what is before us. So I want to understand whether we all understand what the chairman is saying. You say the bill carries principles. It's principle based. So those provisions, because either it's law, it's not law. It can't be half pregnant. Either it creates obligation or doesn't create obligations. And what you're saying is that it doesn't create obligations on the citizenry until one or two things happen. Either a code is enacted, or someone complains, the regulator investigates, he sends an order to somebody to comply with the principle. That order is the source of the obligation. Failing compliance with the order, then there is a criminal procedure process which applies. Is that a correct restatement of your guidance, Mr. Chairman?
I think so. I mean, where is the gap?
It's the gap is in here.
Notification as a device before you start processing. Then companies, firms, or entities are going to have to let the regulator first carry out his, I forget what the word is, his assessment of whether it's going to be all right. And he might then decide to do a second 13-week assessment. So it depends whether we keep that in or not. Otherwise, correct.
All right. And
well,
can I just react to her?
So she can react to my
reaction
to her. The chairman's approach, if I understand it correctly, would answer to that question, is that there where the urgency exists, there will be a code. So the notification requirement would not be a suspensive condition. It wouldn't be a situation of having to wait until something happens. The code would give that immediacy of prescription, that immediacy of action that addresses the issue. It is for the areas not covered by the code that the mechanism of notification would come into place, and therefore the concern that you are raising then would become relevant. And one would rely on the regulator to do enough of a good job to identify those areas in which the concern that you identified should not be allowed to arise, and therefore cover those areas with a call.
I think it's just important to note that the bill is immediately applicable to everybody. It's not as if there has to be a code or there has to be a complaint for the bill to kick in. It kicks in immediately insofar as it is applicable in terms of clause 3. If it's in a file, if you are collecting the information in a file or it's automated information, then you have to comply with the bill. It kicks in this sense that if somebody doesn't complain or something doesn't happen, then, you know, the further, the principles kick in immediately, but I mean the further parts of the act will then kick in. Something will happen or there will be some consequences if somebody complains or whatever. Insofar as the notification is concerned, it's important, the notification is really there for the regulator to know what's going on in this area that he has to regulate. So that everybody has to do immediately. And then it also empowers him to see if there are problems in the area. So even if somebody hasn't complained, the initiative can be taken by the regulator to investigate a specific industry, for instance, or to initiate the code of conduct for that industry. If it's a very, say for instance the banking industry will definitely have a code of conduct because big business will have a code of conduct because there are issues there that you won't find in a normal situation. For instance, various sub-companies, working together and having contractual relationships and things like that, which is very difficult, and somebody will have to sit and really look at the principles and see how that's going to impact on those kind of relationships. But I'm not so worried about that because they're really doing that already since they have to comply with international agreements already. But they will, for instance, have a code of conduct. But just the ordinary person or the ordinary company, whatever, keeping their records in a file or mostly in automated files, they will just comply with it anyway, the principles, even if there is no code of conduct or if there hasn't been a complaint.
Clarity on your first point. It's broader than the Act applies, or the bill, or the Act when it's passed will apply to everybody. But nothing happens. Okay, I'd say there has to be let's forget about the codes. I'd say there has to be a complaint to activate it. I agree with you. You've said it's broader. The regulator, of its own volition, can look at something that doesn't have to wait for a complaint. But basically, until the regulator does something, it doesn't affect people. So the fruit seller on the road to Ulundi, I'm not sure quite what personal information she's collecting or he, is not going to get bothered. The Act applies to them, but the regulator is unlikely to investigate the data collection practices of fruit sellers on our main highways, and nobody is likely to table a complaint to the regulator about it. So that category of persons and it would be many in society, would actually not get affected by the act until the regulator is activated themselves, whether of their own or through a complaint. So the only change I'm saying in terms of what I'd said is general application applies to everybody once it's passed, but it only starts having an effect once the regulator is activated, once the regulator takes action, does something, or is activated either through a complaint or of their own volition. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yes, I think I agree with what you're saying, but I just want to make the point, you know, if you're regulating human trafficking, everybody immediately agrees and the trafficker has no say at all. We are regulating the upstanding citizens of the country. But having said that, so obviously we try to take it into consideration, and there's a lot of balancing. That's what our whole act is about, the balancing of the different rights. But what we must remember is what we're actually doing is not so much, we shouldn't be so much concerned about the responsible parties. What we're trying to do is protect the data subjects. And I hope that the act will have immediate effect on every single person in South Africa, you know, when it comes into. So to say the act will only have effect, you're actually just talking about the regulators, and they are the traffickers, you know.
It's amazing how what government does to people's minds. I do believe that the traffickers should be consulted or anyone else. We make laws. I mean, before you criminalize, it's a mindset issue. Before you criminalize somebody is not a criminal. And we need to apply the mind to what one does. I mean, this high-handed government attitude, and I accept that there are sectors in all the government buildings which still control attitudes, but I have a problem here. What you're saying, Mr. Chairman, is one thing. And this has gone on, it's like talking between two people don't want to hear. Well, it's gone on now since the beginning, where every time the response we get back is, yes, but that's how the bill operates. Try to understand it. Here we need to decide, the three of us girls, how do we want this bill to operate? Oh, I'm sorry. Four of us. No, I mean, it was a Macbethian reference. So, and if it is the way you would have told me that it was not parliamentary, but if it is the way we feel ought to be done, then that's the way it's going to happen. Because it's not just the consequences of the act, it's the consequences of something being illegal. Whether that gives rise to a civil action, that can give rise to an action in delict, whether that can be rise, the qualification of something of being wrongful in law carries a series of consequences. That if damages arise out of something being wrong, somebody can sue. And it doesn't, I mean, we've been making absurd. Not an absurd, but a real. We've been ridiculing the issue, making reference to the seller on the road to Yulundi. But there is the vast number of SSMEs, which is government policy to try to assist, which we do know will not be compliant. And so I really call on you to give a direction, Mr. Chairman, because I think that the gap is clear between what you are saying and the way the bill reads. And from a point of view, reformulation becomes very simple. This bill applies to, one, all those subjected to a code adopted in terms of the principles, two, all those to whom a notice in terms of Section 8 where that is being issued on the basis of a complaint received. That's the section.
Not that the bill applies to them. The bill applies to everybody. It's that consequences kick in, and those were the chairman's words. Consequences kick in when a complaint is lodged or once a code is drafted and people within their industry have their own adjudicator. But the thing applies to everybody, and I would not be so sentimental about the SMMEs if I were you. I mean, this is precisely some of the little web-based businesses who go around stealing people's data and plundering their accounts, their cell phone accounts, for example. I don't know why you assume that a little business won't transgress on people's privacy.
I'm not necessarily. We need to apply it on this issue. And I'm not saying the way it is, because I don't. I mean, I'm just trying to. There are two views here between what I hear the chairman expressing and what I hear Dean understanding he expresses. If the act applies, the consequences flow. Not the penalty. The penalty is just one aspect of the act, but the characterization of the conduct being unlawful. If we go back to your example of the small website, if we step in within the realm of stealing information, if the fraud, etc., I mean, that's there is protection, but the very breach of those requirements would give rise to an action in law, whether it's delict, whether it's as the bill is phrased now, whether it's a contract action, whatever it is, just by not having complied with an obligation which is before you. So I think that this is quite critical. And now I will not go into raise this anymore.
I don't know whether the issue of unlawfulness and effectively, I would see unlawfulness as part of criminal conduct is where the problem is. But as the bill stands at the moment, we're effectively not creating crimes. So there isn't unlawfulness if you don't follow the principles. Okay? It's not a crime, but you're basically creating the situation where the regulator can then intervene to say this conduct is the regulator effectively can make it a crime. I don't know if that's what you've got the problem with, because you hint quite often at the problem of
the
power of the regulator.
There is a provision that says thou shall inform all those whose personal contacts have that you've got that contact. It's a simple provision. And it's thou shall. Now, are you and I going to be subjected to that? The enforcement comes only when we receive a notice from the regulator. That notice is a declarator, declares that we have, it's like a motion to show cause. We have information that you've done this, clarify whether you've done it. If you've done it, stop doing it. But by virtue of complying, we are in a situation of unlawful conduct. So my entire question is about the shell. Is the Dow shell?
Yeah, you see, I mean, look, I agree with you on that point. I've always been uncomfortable with the what's the point of saying shell if there's no consequence. I do note that the British, the UK one, for example, refers to rights. So they phrased it differently, which maybe overcomes that problem. But yes, I and Mark, I don't know if you can come in as well. I mean, you're involved in this in terms of explanation. I think there's quite clearly an intention, and I didn't notice a difference between what Ms. Smuts and I were saying. The Act is principle-based, does not create offences for not following the principles. So you don't have the problem of the unenforceability of a law that applies so generally that everybody becomes a criminal through not following it. it's what is the word? Is it normative? It's what you should do. Okay. Sorry? No. Prescriptive is what you must do. This is what you should do. Okay? And it is then to the regulator, either through a complaint or through their own investigation, to say that this small SMME, which normally should have been left on its own, but because they are actually violating people's rights to privacy, must not do this again, and therefore an order is issued. And that is where the offence gets created, with the application of the principles by the regulator to a specific situation. It could also happen through the codes. That's a wider application. But it can be the regulator saying, okay, here are the principles of what you should do. This person, data collector, has not done it. This is wrong. Thou shalt not do this again. And there's an order that's then issued by the regulator saying effectively that. And if the data collector then carries on doing it, they will then have been committing a crime. So I don't know. Can I just get people who agree with me first? and then because I just want to try and get some kind of agreement on a position that we can then move out from and then discuss those who don't agree. So, Dean, do you agree with me on that formulation?
Yes,
and
I
JB,
do,
do you agree
I would,
with me?
But I would A, like to hear Mark Hank, and B, you have not touched on the civil remedy that is created.
Well,
can sue for damages.
Yes, yeah. That's the civil thing, but that's not criminal. I'm talking about criminal offences, basically.
Okay.
So, Ananda, are you agreeing with me, or you want reservations? And okay, Mark, then you're agreeing with me. You haven't said anything. Do you want to say something now?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do agree with you, and I think that part of the secret is really just to look at the title of the Act, of the Bill, Protection of Personal Information, and that, as Ananda says, it's the data subject. So, the intention is surely that all of our personal information is protected by this bill, and there are principles around which people should act, and if they fail to act in that way, there's a mechanism, and because, as you correctly said in your introduction, because we are dealing with something which is a very, very quickly moving target, changes every day, we are seeing different principles being and practices being developed around the world, which give further guidance to this. We see it in the information security field, which has been spawned to a large extent by ensuring that there's compliance with privacy protections, etc. So from that perspective, my view is I agree with you, and I think that we should understand that the principles are broad principles because of where we are at the moment, and that they will require interpretation by regulators and commissioners, and that has happened in other jurisdictions.
I do agree. I agree completely with you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to make sense with what it is that I'm agreeing with. And forgive me, the only way I can make sense of things is by writing legislation. Because that's what we're talking about. It's not principle intention, so we're here to write this legislation. So let me try to see whether I capture what you're saying correctly. No legal consequence shall flow from the breach of or not compliance with chapters X, Y, Z unless the data subject is, one, subject to a code, two, has received a notice in terms of section XYZ. The data processor. So no legal effect shall flow from the
breach of or non-compliance with chapter XYZ until the data processor, one, is the subject of a code, two, has received a notice in terms of section XYZ. Is that what your suggestion is, Mr. Chairman?
Look, aside from the notification issues, I mean, I don't think one would want to put a clause like that into the bill, but I think that is largely the effect. Aside from the notification, and then whether we make specific offences that apply immediately. But is that not what, I mean, everybody was in agreement, is that not, I'm throwing it open then to everybody apart from Dr. Ambrosini, because he's asking the question, is that not then what we are effectively saying?
On a point of clarification of what you're saying, because I mean, we've got to be precise here. You can't say that's what I want, but that's not what I want to write into the bill. I mean, this is not politician's language, it's legal language. So what, if it is, if that's what you want, we've got to write it into it. If that's not what you want, what is it that you do want?
We can put decide whether it goes in or not, but is this what we are saying the bill should do?
Is that what you want?
I'm Ananda. And Cesar, sorry.
My understanding, Chair, is that what the bill is saying is this is what you should do when you're processing information. And then you put up a regulator as an enforcement mechanism. Then if you fail to comply with the regulator's order or what is it called, a compliance notice, then you are in breach of the law, and then you are subject to a sanction. And then there's also Section 94, which says that you can be, I mean, a data subject can institute a civil action for damages. So if we follow the route that Dr. Ambrosini is talking about, then we'll be taking that Section 94 out, because it would mean that the legislation is not applicable. The legislation doesn't have legal effect before there is a compliance notice or there is a code by the regulator or for a specific.
Maybe we shouldn't use the term legal effect because of the legal effect is so wide. What we've been effectively talking about is criminal effect. Yes, I don't know. It just is narrower and easier to work from, and my concern has been criminalizing conduct because legal effects may impact on the civil remedies. And the fact that you didn't follow the principles may increase your chances of civil liability, for example. So legal effect, I'm a bit worried, it's quite wide. But Ananda, do you want to come in here?
Yes, I just want to make a few different points, but just insofar as this last discussion is concerned, I think what one must also remember is the whole point of the Act is really to be proactive in nature. It's there, the regulator is there, and the powers that the Act provides to the regulator is there to assist people to get their systems in place, to do assessments, to assist people. They can come to the regulator, he will advise them, he will mediate if there are problems, he will tell you are not doing it correctly, this is the way it should be done, etc. So I would have a problem with them saying the Act only comes into effect once a complaint has been lodged, because then you've already sort of overstepped the mark.
I think the issue is that the criminal consequences come into effect. The Act applies. One would want guidelines by the regulator or whoever else is responsible to say this is for the public, this is how you should collate information and disseminate and process, etc. So that would come out beforehand. The public are encouraged to abide by that. But the criminal consequences, the restrictions, come in when these two factors that Dr. Ambrosini has raised happen, a complaint or a notice, an order rather, and the code.
Can I?
Yeah, but we are not.
I just want to. I just wanted to make the second point. The mere fact that the code has been put in place also doesn't have the same effect as a complaint being lodged, because the code really takes the place of the legislation, and then in terms of the code, a complaint can then be lodged, and then and also it only starts. So the mere fact that there's a code is also not.
See, I mean, we get all these answers in terms of how the bill works, and the mere fact that the code is there doesn't make any difference. That's on the way the bill is. I would like to be discussing how the bill could be and what are the pros and cons of what the bill could be. And we cannot engage in this discussion, and I've got that enormous difficulty. But I would like you to disabuse yourself, Mr. Chairman, from the notion of should. Should doesn't exist. There is no such a thing in law. So it's either shall or you do as you wish. The people who come to the regulator to be assisted, they do so because they are under a legal obligation to comply. And if we are true to our job description of making laws, we need to have clarity whether we are telling people that there is a legal obligation or there isn't a legal obligation. And this thing that there is a legal obligation but there is no sanction if you don't comply until we hit you over the head with a notice, it's not the way of legislating, because those sanctions come from the law. The law is a complex system of responsibility, liability, the breach of a legal obligation. Unless you put it clearly, then it will have consequences. So I plead on you not to shy away from this fundamental issue. Let's make a decision. Let's not solve it by fudging it, because by fudging it, we are just doing poor legislation, which will have unforeseen consequences. So we throw the burden of this discussion onto the regulator and onto the citizenry, and we're not fulfilling our responsibility. I don't have a position. I would just like you to express clearly your position, Mr. Chairman, saying that's the way I want it, shall or no shall.
The difficulty with the shell is you then start making it prohibited conduct if you don't do it, and if you don't provide for consequences, well, you're not providing for consequences for not following it, for not not abiding by that. That's the difficulty I've got with shell, and that's why I would have preferred. Should, that this is what you should do rather than what you must do, because the net is then just cast so wide. Mark, you've got...
Chairman, I think that you raised the point that we should encourage the public to deal with information in that way, but I think there's another side to that, and again, I come back to the issue of the expectation of how other people will deal with my information. And I think that the citizens should have a legitimate expectation that, or rather, an expectation that their information will be dealt with legitimately. And in the, just dealing with the question of shall and should, we are dealing with a concept of principles which need interpretation. It has worked in other jurisdictions, and while I'm not trying to argue the point around shall and should, the point is simply that either we need rules-based legislation or otherwise we need principle-based legislation. And principle-based legislation is the only legislation that is going to work in the context here.
I think the difficulty, what we were scared of with the musts, the shalls, is... providing a situation which is not impossible or not complied with by the majority of people. But maybe looking at each use of the word must or may only, maybe there are sufficient covers when we get to that. Maybe that's something we should check as we go along. Ananda.
I just want to go back to something that Sambasinghe said previously, you know, about a person having to inform the data subject that he has information, and that's very difficult, and it places people under a huge burden. One mustn't forget the exceptions in each principle, which actually forms part of the principle and is a qualification for that principle, because 17.6 says it's not necessary to comply with this principle. For instance, if non-compliance would not prejudice the legitimate interests of the data subject, or if compliance is not reasonably practicable in the circumstances of the particular case, or, you know, there are a number of these exceptions. So really, for the small person that finds it overly burdensome to comply with that, there are exceptions that may provide a solution for the problem that he is raising. That is why the principles worldwide are called good business practice. They are being dealt with by people worldwide because they are so reasonable and they are not overly burdensome to any business.
I have 3 law degrees. I've been practicing for 32 years, and I don't know, reading those 2 sections that you just quoted, whether my having your phone number, Ananda, creates the obligation for me to let you know. I mean, this is what we're talking about. Citizens cannot be subjected to principles. Organs of state are. Citizens can only be subjected to a thou shalt do, or you can do as you wish.
Mario, you keep raising this point, and I'm not sure. Well, I are you correct? I don't actually feel that you are. I don't see why we can't do a law like this. This bill has been through an extensive consultation process through the Law Commission and then the Public Submissions. I don't remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, particularly Christine, did anybody complain about the matter that Dr. Ambrosini is raising, that you cannot have principle-based legislation for citizens? I don't think so.
The bill is fine the way it is, from a technical viewpoint, and it is not principle-based. It does have obligations. Ananda's viewpoint is, hey, don't worry, those obligations are not so terrible because there are all sorts of exemptions and limitations, and you can get out of this, you can get out of that. But it is obligation-based, it's not principle-based. I made 2 points, and I'm sorry, there's been a few that's been collapsing. One, the first point is that in defining the nature of the obligation, it's very difficult. I would have difficult to understand whether my own situation vis-a-vis their phone number falls within under one of the exemptions. That's not a principle, it's a matter of interpreting the law. The issue of the principles I've raised it about your point, Mr. Chairman, and the point Mark was raising, which is all about the should. Let's just create some principles and let us encourage people to comply, because it's not a must, it's a should, and that's a principle which applies to the citizenry.
I think let's leave the should, shall, must issue. I think that's a non-issue. I think it's confusing us. I don't think it's helping us. I think let's go back to where we were at the beginning in terms of the statement of the intention with the bill, and let's proceed from there. We do want it to apply to everybody, but the criminal consequences, or the prohibited consequences, aside from the civil remedies, the prohibited consequences or prohibitory consequences would come into effect through the regulator. at this stage with the way the bill is phrased. So let's proceed from that point of view. At the same time, we should be mindful of the fact that we don't want to prohibit conduct that is unprohibitable in terms of the daily exercise. So how we word those principles should be broad enough. Can we take it from there? Dean, you wanted to say something.
No, absolutely, and I wanted to get back to Hank's document. Now, just to say that all of the people who made submissions understand perfectly crisply and clearly that there are major consequences for them, and some of them have estimated that it's going to cost them $200 million in order to re-establish their data banks, as indeed they should, because they've been doing exactly as they pleased for a very long time. So they will understand that there are very concrete consequences for the way they do automated communication and the transfer of files. But then, and to go directly back to Hink's document, if I may, and Borio's repeated assertion that this affects his personal phone book, which it absolutely does not. Thank you, Hink, in the first place, for splitting Clause 3 into two parts. That's exactly what I asked, because it was my argument that our existing Clause 3 tries to put two different things into one clause, and the one was the application of the Act in the territorial sense, and the other thing was the application of the Act to its subject matter, which is automated data banks and information transmitted with automated equipment or non-automated in certain circumstances. He has now split them into two, which I think helps. And the question to me now becomes, especially under B, whether we have captured what it is we want and which will address Mario's concern. Because this Act is supposed to apply to the consequences of computerization and the big data banks that get built as a result. Unfortunately, it doesn't limit itself only to automated systems and information carried thereon, but also to files that are structured in such a way that they can feed into those data banks. So to me, I would just like to satisfy myself whether especially the B tells us that this bill is about automated information. By making use of automated or non-automated means, provided that when the recorded personal information is processed by non-automated means, it forms part of a filing system or is intended to form part thereof. And then Henker suggests that we make more definitions, which I think is right. And may I just remind you that the EU directive, for what it's worth, because I know that better than the OECD, very specifically says that unstructured files shall under no circumstances fall within the scope of the directive. So, you know, if necessary, maybe we should say such a thing. You already have an exception for personal or household files, which, I mean, should tell Dr. Ambrosini that he's worried about nothing. But perhaps we could refer to unstructured files, or files not constructed in terms of criteria, as they're usually called. But so my first offering, Chair, is simply to say thank you very much for splitting this clause into two. And if it's still not clear that we're talking about computerization and its consequences, then maybe we should look at subclause B even some more.
B is not just about automated, though, Dean. It's also non-automated.
Regulating non-automated files that are not going to make their way into computers, in my view. I may be wrong. But in as much as the principle is that you don't intrude on people's privacy, yes, fair enough, but it's because of computerization and automation that the need for this bill arose at all. Before that, it wasn't like that. You know, you had grey-painted steel filing cabinets and all sorts of social convention and the fragmentation, as has been argued, that existed between sectors, professions, and so forth, ensured the privacy. Now that the steel cabinet has disappeared and everything is online and easily transmitted, that's what created the problem. Bengt is looking unhappy.
Mr.
chair. I'm a slow thinker. I'm thinking of the example of, for example, let's say insurance companies having records of policies. I've got a policy now for 40 years, for example. Those things are most probably still on file. That's the one aspect thereof. The other aspect is that it's sometimes difficult to draw the distinction between where you've got your automated and non-automated transition. It may be that the companies transfer their files to electronic data, but they still do have those files available, and they still have the potential of, let's rather say, the need for regulation of the processing of that information. Does not really make a difference. One could say, yes, we are in automated age, but strictly speaking, and Ananda can correct me if I'm wrong, filing systems must be covered. I simply don't have any doubt.
The question, yeah, I don't think there's any dispute that it's automated and non-automated. I think the issue would be, do you use the term automated means anywhere else in the Act or the Bill? If not, then rather don't put a definition of automated. Rather put that into the clause. It makes it easier to read. You only have a definition if you're going to use that term often, and so you don't have to keep repeating it. But rather than maybe doing it B, by use of one, automated means through any equipment capable, blah, blah, what you put in the definition. And then two would be non-automated means provided that, that proviso. And you can maybe, if you don't use the filing system anywhere else in the bill, then put the definition of filing system into the clause. It just makes it easier to read. Otherwise, you've got to read the clause. I mean, this is a very difficult clause to understand. I must tell you that from my side. Maybe Dr. Ambrosini, with his three law degrees, finds it easy, but it's not me.
Can we try to depersonalize this discussion, Mr. Chairman?
You brought up the fact that you have three law degrees, not me.
Okay, now the difficulty I have, and I need to bring them into this discussion because I feel them genuinely, it's not ideological, is that we have a sense of what it is that we are trying to deal with. But then we grasp for language which doesn't necessarily reflect it. The people who came before us, those who accepted the burden, well, those who told us that there is a burden, 200 million rands that spoke as indeed. And they came before us, they recognized the need, they accepted it. They are a minority as compared to all the other businesses to which this bill will be applied. Yes, indeed. It does apply to you and I, and just come to terms with it, because it's not the information we have about one another is not personal. Our relationship is not personal, it's professional. And the word automated is not where we get out of the problem. And to me, the word automated doesn't add any much. This computer is automated. Our cell phone is automated. Yes, we are excluding the paper files. So what? I mean, it's... I don't know anyone who still has paper files. So what is... I mean, what are we grasping when we use the word automated? I mean, are we clutching for straws? I mean, what does it add or what does it exclude that is not there already?
Era, that I mean, a lot of
what
what's in
excluding?
The legislation. Sorry, what are you excluding? You're excluding basically unstructured filing systems.
Like my cell phone?
No.
Like what?
That would be writing on bits of paper and scattering it around the place.
Okay, so this is excluded?
Yeah.
Oh, good. So I think this discussion is way too laborious, if we're, that's all we're dealing with.
A relevant filing system means any set of information relating to individuals to the extent that, although the information is not processed by means of equipment operating automatically in response to instructions given for that purpose, the set is structured either by reference to individuals or by reference to criteria relating to individuals in such a way that specific information relating to a particular individual is readily accessible. I'm afraid to my mind, I don't know. I mean, I have difficulty with understanding the B part, Hink's draft, but I don't think the British one is much better either. I mean, it's fine until you start getting onto relevant filing system. The relevant filing system is all over the place.
The matter is that any document in MS Word, any list of names in MS Word, will achieve that functionality. That functionality has now become such a basic feature of any computer program. It's a control A function.
Mr. Chairman, I think just relating to issues of records that are perhaps filed, you know, one of the examples that I can give, which is currently the case, is that medical records, bed letters, etc., in most of our public hospitals are not computerized. They contain extremely important personal information.
I think the issue is not so much whether, I think Dean's question around desire to have it only applying to automated, I think that was dropped a while ago. I think there would be consensus it applies to automated and non-automated. So the medical records would be in. I think the other aspect would be that we want this definition to be as broad as possible because of what's coming later, that it's easier to get out of things later, rather throw this net wide. If you throw it too narrow, you're going to leave some things out which were unintended. One of the things remembering as well is that technology is speeding along fast, so we're legislating for technology and ways of storing things that we don't necessarily know about. So we want a definition that is wide. I would see Dr. Ambrosini's concern as being, let me not put it in his words, but mine would be this is pretty wide. Would it not be better to say what is excluded, rather than what is in? Although I don't think too much hinges on this aspect. I wouldn't want to spend too much time on it. We could maybe look at whether there's a better wording. I mean, Henk, there are some aspects of the British system, British definition of data, which are easier to follow, although I think they lose it when it comes to relevant filing systems. Mark, I don't know if you've got any wording that you would suggest, but the question is basically a B part that is understandable. So it's not about excluding non-automated, non-computerized records. It's about having it understandable. Mario, you still had your hand up or you've dropped it?
No.
Great. Anybody else? So look, can we move on from this clause? I think let's tag it, and I think really the tagging is the concern around its understandability. I don't know if that's being unfair, Hink. But what is this clause saying? What we want this clause to say, and it's what it's saying, and is there a more understandable way of saying it? Dean's suggestion was that the British one was a bit more understandable. I'm not sure if I agree, but doesn't really matter. Is there a better way of putting it? I think that's all. So nothing wrong with the principle. Okay, can we move on? Can we go then to sub two. That's the way you've dealt with the principles. Does anybody want to start on that one? My problem is I don't know if you really addressed. That's not my phone. I don't know if it is. I don't know if you really addressed the. You've shifted the words around. That's all. Principle 5 is still what is there in what is principle 5? Let's take principle 3. It's what's there in 12 to 14. Purpose specification. It's clauses 12, 13, 14. Is the retention of record section a principle? So I don't know if you've dealt with it. I mean, unfortunately here I like the British system, which is, where is it? Yeah, but they refer to it in the schedule. I've lost it. Yeah, but they haven't. I had expected the principles, the 8 of them, to be listed rather than a single word, and rather than the cross referencing to the sections. I think maybe if I'm trying to get my head around what I've got a concern with, I don't know whether other people share that concern. Mario.
You would want the principle, Mr. Chairman. And you're struggling with the difficulty that what's under the principle is not a principle and it's a law. So here you would want to have a principle, but what dealing afterward is the law. So what they've done is correct. There is no space for a principle. And if we put a principle there, then you're going to be struggling with the difficulty of what is the relationship between the principle and the law, and what is the purpose of the principle. Being the way it is now, the less confusing thing would be just to get out of all this principle language, I would eliminate the word principle completely, because the principles are in the directive, because it is a directive. And the principles are such because they inform the discretion of the regulator in adopting codes. But I would have, if it were up to me, I would have just made them all the provisions, and then when it comes to the code, I would say codes should be consistent with the previous provisions, because I don't see a principle is something that either informs the exercise of discretion or is the capacity of expanding itself into something more. And being the bill the way it's structured, I just don't understand where the interplay can take place.
Mario, also remember that the principles do not just apply to the codes. They apply to everybody's conduct as far as the processing of data.
It's a principle which is basically a concentrate of what's already there. You take the five sections and you write three lines trying to summarize what's in the five sections. What are you really doing?
These principles apply, I'll give you now, these principles apply to everybody. Just let's look at what the British did. And it's actually, I found the section. It's section 4, okay? And they basically say, section 4, the data protection principles. References in this act to the data protection principles are to the principles set out in part 1 of Schedule 1. And there you have eight sentences, effectively, as far as I can see. I think they've broken up, but it's 8 points. They're short, they're sweet. Okay? Then you've got under 4.2. These principles are to be interpreted in accordance with part 2 of Schedule 1. And there you've got the detail. And I think that's my worry, that what Ananda, you've done in the South African bill is you've taken out the meat of what is there is actually how you interpret the principle. And is it not better to do what the British have done, to say, these are the principles. These principles, sub 2 or whatever. The following principles shall apply to the processing of personal information. 1 to 8. Okay? And then the next chapter is interpretation of the principles, as the British have done them. And there you have the meat as to what is in clause, starting from wherever, starting from, you know, the different clauses that you've got. Ananda, what do you think about that?
You know, we actually started off, I also thought that we had to have the little sort of sentences in each, but I was actually convinced that it would be very difficult, and I think I agree more or less what Ms. Ambassini said about that, because it started to be very difficult to actually do that if you're not going to go the UK way, you know, all the way, and have it rather in say, for instance, in an annexure, and then saying, for instance, it's subject to the following information principles as set out in Annexure A and interpreted in Section 7, 8, or whatever. So you can do that, but I think you will have to take it out of the Act, because it's almost impossible to have it as part of the Act and then not going the, you know, getting substantive provisions, which are now in one place and also in another place, which makes it very difficult. Perhaps Ian can also say something about that. What I just want to say about the UK Act is that I don't know if once you get to know it may be easier, but it is known worldwide that this is an exceptionally difficult Act to understand, because what happens with all the different schedules is that you have to understand one section in the Act. You have to go to five schedules to actually understand what that one is. So actually what we've tried to do is actually do that work for the poor responsible party or data subject who wants to understand. We've actually done that and put it in one place. Yes. So, but I mean, I'm not saying it was a success, but we've tried to do that, because otherwise somebody else, I mean, I tried to do that after, yes, and I mean, I've tried to do that, to put it in one place after studying this whole issue for how many years, and now you expect a responsible party to be able to do that for each little thing that you want to understand. So, I'm
not arguing for schedules. Okay, what I'm suggesting is this. Chapter 3, conditions for lawful processing of personal information. Clause 7, or whatever we get to. The following principles shall apply to the processing of personal information. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So 7, 1, 7, 2, 7, 3, 8. In the clause 7. Okay. Clause 8. Well, that's a sort of introduction to the chapter. This is chapter 3. That's clause 7, then, is almost the introduction. The following principles shall apply. The principles shall be interpreted according to the following, or something like that. So putting it in the body, taking out this thing, what I like with the UK is the separation between principle and interpretation, which you don't find in the bill. Okay, it's not there as far as I can see, or it's too subtle. Okay, I like that concept. Can't we find a way of putting that in our bill? And along the way, the lines that I'm talking about. So, start of chapter 3, the conditions. The following principles shall apply, clause 7. List them 1 to 8, 7, 1, 7, whatever to 8. Then your next clause the principles shall be interpreted in the following way, but use the word interpret or applied maybe, applications, or maybe chapter 3 is principles, chapter 4 is application of principles, because that's what we're talking about application. Is that not a way of dealing with it?
We'll certainly have a look at it, but maybe just to come back.
No, we think we need time, but this is a fundamental point. I'd like more discussion. Maybe if you're with Hank, can you take time to meet? Maybe the other members of the committee, maybe you'd be quiet. I know you haven't been grappling with it as much as the rest of us. We're not being on the subcommittee, but Christine, Mark, anyone else?
Or within the body of the law, but this is my reason.
Two concerns, and I would just like to, we don't need to look at our application force or our roadmap, but that is something that we had a look at in trying to stipulate our principles there. There were two concerns. The first one was, since we dealing with an application force or roadmap provision, we or I personally, because this was my call to do it this way, was to insert a substantive provision of an obligation there, which might contradict the remainder of this chapter, if it remains the same. Exactly the concern that Dr. Andresini raised. The second concern might be even a bit more technical. I don't think we'll be able to reach 8 principles. It might be more, it might be less. For example, if we look at what we have as principle 1 at this stage, accountability, there's nothing much more to be said. So strictly speaking, as soon as we start talking about the application of our principles, we will have, for example, then only application provisions for 7 principles and not 8 principles. That's the first concern that I have. The second concern that I have is that, and really, we undertook a separate exercise in this regard. I tried it first, and I mentioned it to Ananda, and she didn't believe me, and she also tried it, and it's extremely difficult. I'm just really, I think the advantage that we have is that if we go through these principles, clause by clause, we can possibly even try to identify them and see with how many we end up. So I wouldn't like to provide you with a straight yes or no at this stage. I would rather prefer to say that it might be possible to do so, but we might end up with something that we will not expect, number one. Number two, I think it will affect the user-friendliness. I really think it will affect the user-friendliness of our provisions, of our goal.
I never thought accountability sounded like a principle to me anyway. It doesn't exist in the EU one, or in certain not in the UK Act. I know it's in the OECD, but it's at the bottom. And to me, it's just a clause, a section. I don't think it is a principle. But I'm...
we need to write the law. Then the regulator will write the booklet. The book. No, but I mean, because there's constantly in this parliament the temptation to write the booking at the beginning of the law. Yeah, but user-friendly, look at what's happening to the jurisprudence, or look at what's happening to the lawyers. I mean, you make laws that people can read and lawyers can't read and judges can't read. The law must set out rights, obligations, prescripts.
Okay. Cesar, Christine, Mark,
Anyone? Mark?
I share the reservations that Henk has around the drafting, but I think that might be coloured by the fact that I've been dealing with this for longer and I don't have a difficulty with the way that it is set out at the moment.
I would dare to say that once we have made, as you have for us, the decision that the bill is fine the way it is, and we are happy with the criminalization without the imposition of the crime, then the bill is fine the way it is. I mean, I would do very much, I could live without this entire new section 1 as rephrased and go back to the original bill, because it doesn't add anything. It just complicates. There is no point in having a provision which tells what the other provision says. The only substantive part, which is very, very, very important, and I'm surprised that hasn't been discussed by you too, is 3B and 6B. That is new. 1-3B and 1. So 3-3B and 3-6B. Now, that is new. Am I right? No? Is there a power of the regulator to exclude? Or in terms of 34? Or in terms of chapter 4? Yes. Okay, no, you're right. Okay, so let's take the back. Apology. I'm jet lagged. But why do we need to do this rephrasing? It doesn't really add anything. Yeah, no, but the difficulty came out of these issues of principles. But if we eliminate from the bill the word principles and we just call them part, accountability, just let's eliminate the word principle, and then we add somewhere an additional provision that says in developing codes the regulator should take cognizance of sections X to Y and its underpinning principles and intentions, then we're all fine.
Yeah, but it's not just for developing codes. It's for dealing with data processing.
No, but the data processor is not subject to the principles. It's subject to the words under the principles.
Yeah.
So if you data processor,
the principles versus the application.
Yeah, there are no principles which apply to the citizens. The actual words, the thou shalt not. And that's where you want it. So
principles do apply to everybody.
Yeah, but they're not principles. They're provisions.
I'm talking about the principles that are principles.
Where is the principle that is a principle? Can somebody refer me to a principle that is a principle?
I think the one was the easy one was 9. Personal information may only be processed if given the purpose for which it is processed is adequate, relevant, and not excessive.
But that's a provision which will need to be interpreted by law, by courts. It's an extremely word provision. It's a may or may not. So with the indirect provision in Kelsian terms is thou shalt not, unless it is reasonable. Now, reasonable, there are all sorts of things which are reasonable, but it's a provision, broadly phrased, cumbersome, unclear, but provision nonetheless is not a principle.
Maybe the way of dealing with it would be to go through clauses 7 onwards and follow the exercise that Henk suggested of what is a principle, what is an application. I don't know if we can do much else with the roadmap, or whether we come back to it at the end.
The roadmaps in the Middle East, it never worked.
I think if we can perhaps look at an example, say principle 2, and we say in our first list, we say there should be limits to the collection of personal data and any such personal information. There should be limits to the collection of personal information, and any such information should be obtained by lawful and fair means and where appropriate with the knowledge or consent of the data subject. That would be the principle. And then have it in the text later on, everything as it is at the moment. Would that... That would be in clauses 8 to 11. Because if you say as the principle in your section where you list the principles, you say, okay, processing limitation, talking about principle 2, processing limitation, and you say there should be limits to the collection of personal data, and any such information should be obtained by lawful and fair means and where appropriate with the knowledge or consent of the data subject. That's the principle there. And then when you get to the second part of the act where you actually, the interpretation, whatever, you have the principle 2 as it is there at the moment. That is possible. That's a possibility. That's something that we tried. But then the concern that Wink raised was that now you've got this section that I've just read, and you can interpret this in a specific way, and you also have this the 8 to 11, which you can maybe interpret in a different way.
To the question of why do you want the principles?
Yes, why do you want to set this? Why do you want? So what I'm thinking, what I'm wondering is, can't you put those principles that you want separately in a schedule and then say in the act, the principles are the ones in schedule 1 as interpreted and whatever.
See, the difficulty, I don't think it makes any difference whether it's in a schedule or in the main body. I mean, it's going to be, it's there for interpretive assistance. It's a question of, does it add value to the act to have them listed wherever they are? And maybe just raise that point. Why? What value will it add, or will it create confusion?
Because the problem that we have is that, you know, the principle is not in all cases just one line. So you've got actually, say, perhaps three sub-principles or whatever, and all of them don't have the same exceptions. The exceptions for sub-principle B is something, and for C something different. So if you take out the sort of the principles and you put it somewhere, and now you must link them again with the correct exception, it gets very confusing, because it's very, you know, it's not as if there's one principle and one exception,
yes,
and one interpretation.
Yeah, but I mean, firstly, it I don't know, I don't see it as such a problem that there's, well, we're not talking about exceptions, it's application. And some are easy to apply, some are not, and have exceptions and all sorts of things. It's a question of, is the value in adding these principles? Where are the 8 principles that you've got from? Are they the EU principles?
OECD.
Okay. The UK ones, they've got 8 principles. They're the EU ones. So we've got EU and OECD, there's obviously an overlap. But do we need to list the EU, if we want to be EU compliant, as it were, do we need to list them? I would have thought that given this is principle-based legislation, that listing the 8 principles does help the interpretation. It's just a question of wording of their interpretation, and it doesn't mean that there's got to be an interpretation for even the clear-cut principles, but that's something else. But I think that's the question of, do you need to list principles? Do they help, or are they just going to add to confusion? Mario,
this discussion of the principles is really bound by the Caliphant argument for the destruction of the Library of Alexandria. Either they add to the Quran, either they detract from the Quran, and they are... No. Okay. Either they detract from the Quran and they need to be destroyed, or they don't, and then they're useless. So, and And this is the situation with the principle. Either they add or detract from the text of the law, and they're dangerous, or they don't, and they're useless. We are stuck with a situation which we shouldn't be stuck with, which is a peculiar European situation where they chose the rule of the tool of the directive rather than the tool of the regulation, so as to enable differentiation of legislation between member states. So then they had to use principles to be implemented by means of state legislation. If the EU had chosen to legislate on this matter by means of regulations rather than directives, we wouldn't be here. So we are inheriting a problem which has got nothing to do with this legislation. There is no need for it. And I would do away with these principles unless somebody comes up with a compelling reason that you are struggling to find after 3 months. I'm struggling to find another hanker producing. So let's move on. I think that the bill was fine as it was introduced to us, if it is what we want. I'm saying, because it comes from a directive. But the OECD cannot legislate. They need to give principles. I've seen the one in Italy and Germany. They don't have it. And in Italy and Germany, there is a tradition of legal solidity, of semantic solidity in what you put into the law. And they also scratch their head and says, "What is a principle?"
It's actually the OECD countries that use the principles because of they are OECD countries. But let me explain that as well. You have EU countries and then you have the OECD, which is the EU countries and other countries. But because the EU is already so strict, they call them EU countries, and the rest they call OECD countries. So the rest of the OECD, which also includes EU but not them, like Australia and Canada and all of them, they all have principles. The EU countries usually don't. Like, you can have a look at the Netherlands bill, and it's referred to Italy and Germany, and also Argentina, for instance, who followed the Spanish legislation. So they don't have it, but the UK have it. But they are always a little bit different because they don't want to follow the EU. So they usually do everything a little different. And they were actually also drawn kicking and screaming into this. They were not so happy with the legislation, but they had to follow the EU. So the UK is not always such a good example. It's a good example for us insofar as the regulator is concerned, because we are going to use that. But insofar as everything else is concerned, they are not really at the forefront of development of the privacy legislation. They followed afterwards. But that's the difference between the EU. And I'm actually sorry, because I tried to marry the two, and perhaps I shouldn't have. And that brought in the OECD and the EU together. Otherwise, if you follow the EU, if you look at the EU directive, they do not refer to principles at all. They just their headings, they call it general rules of lawfulness, and then it's section 1 to 9, and their section in it's principles relating to data quality, criteria for making data processing legitimate, special categories of processing, information to be given to the data subject's right of access to data, exemptions and restrictions, the data subject's right to object, confidentiality and security, and notification. They don't refer to principle 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But what I've just read is exactly the same content-wise as principle 1 to 8 of the OECD.
We will go through clauses 7 to whatever, the so-called principles, and see can we separate it out. The problem has been stated that you need a distinction between a principle and the application or the implementation of that principle. And that's why there's a desire for dividing between the two, for not keeping it as is the moment where you've got a principle and the implementation caught up together. If there's a way of separating it, fine. But otherwise, the question then is, is there any relevance to what value do the principles add? Dr. Ambrosini's question about the was it the caliph or but I'm sure as far as I know, I mean, we can have a historical debate afterwards. The Christians, when they took power in Egypt under the Romans, burnt the Library of Alexander long before the Muslims arrived. But anyway,
covered long before Christians took over.
Sorry,
the Romans took over with Caesar.
Yes, but if you remember, Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire. So I'm saying
That was with Constantine 350 years later, sir.
Before. Yeah, but that is before the
in, library. In 600.
Sorry?
I thought it was burned in 600.
I don't think the Muslims burned the library. Okay, anyway, we can talk about it. We can anyway, the point is, okay. All right. So let's do it, leave it like that for now. Then we The question is, what else do we do with the rest of Clause 3 at the moment? Do we look at the other sections, or do we come back to them? Anand, you wanted to say something on that?
Yes, I think maybe we can go on and leave it, but just park it, because we really think that it would be very helpful to have a roadmap. Maybe not as it is at the moment.
The point is, it's more like... Sorry, my point is not a disagreement of a roadmap. The point is more that let's do the rest of the picture, and then we can see how we can go back to how it's described. So let's leave that for now. Now the issue is the point of, in spite of it being principle based, should we include specific criminal conduct in the bill that does not require the intervention, because as you remember, what we said in the beginning in the summary was it does apply to everybody, but effectively if there are going to be criminal consequences, it needs the activation of the regulator. The question that was being raised was, is that necessary for certain conduct? Is certain conduct not so obviously wrong that in order to protect people's private information, we should criminalize it? And the one point that would spring to mind would be the processing may be too broad, but basically the dissemination of banking details. That is private information. You can't get it publicly. If Vodacom have my bank account details, and anyone else who has a contract with Vodacom, if they give out those details, sell them to somebody who is then able to deduct things, SMS me and deduct things from my bank account, why should I have to wait for the regulator? Why should I have to complain to the regulator? Should that not be prohibited conduct? Criminal. Go to court. So that's the one aspect is banking details, or maybe others. But because at the moment, I think the question is if a shop with whom I have a debit order, or a business with whom I have a debit order, MultiChoice, give out my banking details, have they committed a crime? Does anybody know the answer to that? They haven't committed a crime. Should they not have committed a crime? Given that these problems seem to be becoming more and more prevalent, and then there was the, what is the woman's name, Wendy Knowles? The stuff in her column, and then Ms. Smuster's article of basically people discovering that because people have access to their banking details, they suddenly have deductions. Yeah. Mario, sorry, yeah. He says it's not a...
question was whether it's a crime at the moment.
Yes.
Simply said no.
Then we should we not, as far as protecting personal information, make it a crime, Mario?
See, I come back to this, Mr. Chairman, because you do. The consequence of illegality. An action which is potentially harmless can give rise to consequences which are harmful. One is responsible for the consequences if the original harmless action is illegal. I give your banking details to Dean because I know that she wants to give you a present for your birthday. This action is harmless and not harmful. And it is legal. Let's not go into the exception, Amanda. Let's assume that I make the action illegal because I'm giving your information. And let's assume it doesn't fall under any of the exemptions. Then the action becomes harmless, illegal, and non-harmful, and it's fine. But let's assume that I give the same banking details to somebody who then takes advantage of. So let's assume that Dina herself turns out to be different what she appears to be, and she takes advantage. I give it for one reason, she uses them for a different reason. And then the action is illegal, intended to be harmless, turns out to be harmful. But because it's illegal, I'm responsible, and you can sue me for what she does. And let's set aside that under the specific example I gave and concocted, in 2.5 seconds would be exempted and under the purpose provisions of the bill. But, so this is what it is. Once you make it illegal, whether or not there is criminal sanction, everyone who breaks the parameter of legality is stuck with the consequences of any harmful effect which may derive from them.
Just on that point, I mean, obviously consent is would be or lack of consent would be a requirement. So if you give Vodacom, MultiChoice, whoever your bank details, there's no problem with that. The problem then is if they give it to somebody else. Now, Mario, you've mentioned a case of let's take a personal relationship between two people. I mean, you mentioned if you give my bank account details to Dean, who wants to give me a present. No, who wants to give me a present. Now, you don't have my bank account details. Your wife, okay, you would have hers. I don't know, I would imagine you're married with an anti-nuptial contract, not in community property, but let's say you were married in community of property. Now, you want to give Dean, who's a great friend of your wife's, wants to give your wife a birthday present by putting money into her account. Still, should you be allowed to give your wife your wife's bank account to a third party without her consent? So what I'm trying to ask is, are there any exceptions on the bank account details?
Before you answer that, you're dealing also with another level of difficulty. We are looking at a huge category of personal information in which we don't have a harder core of something which is more personal than the rest is personal. So banking details is not more protected than your sexual preferences, or your shopping patterns, or your eating habits. It goes back to the butcher shop who should not let the rabbi know that his Jewish customers eat pork. So it is within this difficulty of everything being potentially harmful and therefore potentially potentially capable of being protected by making it all illegal makes it compounds it. If we could identify this, is where the code approach satisfies me, because all the problems we are having would be just dumped on the regulators, and they will develop the expertise that you and I right now don't have. And they will learn through the process, and they will feel their way, and they will respond to the call of pain, and surely they will start from the bank accounts, and they will go as necessary.
But the point, the question that we've asked is, are there not categories of processing or dissemination specifically of personal information that should be criminalized immediately? That we can criminalize without having criminalized some unforeseen consequences. And to my mind, the question still stands. The unauthorized, I mean, people's age, your ID number, your email address, your telephone number, your cell phone number, those are all things which are in the public domain already. But your bank account is not. And would there be any unforeseen consequences of criminalizing the dissemination? So I'm not talking about purely processing, but maybe limiting it to dissemination of bank account details without consent of the data subject, without the explicit consent of the data subject. Sorry? ID numbers are freely available. I can find your ID number by going to look in the IFP list for Parliament. It's there. Okay? So that's not a problem. I can go and, yeah, but your bank account detail is. I can't get your bank account detail. So that's the question I'm asking. Are there categories like that? To my mind, and let me put it as a case, that yes, I think we should criminalize. So let people counter it. I think we should criminalize the dissemination of bank account details. Is there anything else that we should, is there agreement, disagreement with that? If there's disagreement, why? If there is agreement, would there be any other categories of information, aspects of information processing that we should also criminalize immediately? And by criminalizing immediately, I mean that is it right that if Henk is correct and that you can, MTN can sell my bank account details or can give somebody my bank account details without any criminal sanction, I don't think that's right. And basically, look, credit card details are a lot easier, but I would include them under banking details. You give your credit card details to somebody to deduct from your account. I'm not talking about skimming. You allow, but you subscribe to the AA. You say to the AA, here's my credit card details. Oh, no. Sterkinikor. You buy movie tickets online. You say deduct tickets from my credit card, and they sell that, and it is so easy to deduct from a credit card. That's not right. So that's the question being thrown open. I don't know if we want to take it. If look, we don't have to finalize the thing now. It's being sprung on people. Dean, maybe you should speak some more on this as well. You're leaving me to...
You basically stated what I've already written. It seems to me a wickedness, and that there should be... It's unconscionable that people can suddenly wake up one morning and find debit orders running against their bank account, which they never had no knowledge of, or charges against their cell phone account routinely for something that they're simply not aware that they are alleged to have subscribed to. And so, as far as I'm concerned, certainly the unlawful obtaining of that data, the sale of that data by somebody in the first place, should be acted against. Isn't there any sort of common law or other provision against running charges against people's accounts. And, I mean, it is outright theft.
And maybe I should... We're talking now about the end result, that is theft. If I sold you the information with the knowledge that you are going to steal, then that's something totally different. I can as a co-perpetrator, be found guilty of theft, number one. Number two, I don't know how those contracts look like if we use the MTN example, but I'm quite sure that there should be a contractual clause that stipulates. I don't even know whether it's necessary to contractually stipulate that you won't sell a person's banking details for purposes of, for whatever purposes. It just simply doesn't make sense. Does it happen? I suppose it does.
It's not knowing that you're intending to steal money, because, I mean, the cases in your article, Dean, was some confusion as to whether the person consented to this contract that they had entered into, and therefore were the people were entitled to deduct or not. So there's a whole lot of grey areas. But Mark, I did have a brief discussion with him beforehand, and you'd also raised that you thought there were other categories that maybe should be criminalised in the bill.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that just coming back to the issue, if we criminalise the sale of information, that seems to me to be the correct approach to take. And I do believe...
Sale of banking information.
The sale of banking information, yes. And I haven't thought through it carefully enough. There might be other areas of information. But for instance, I'm not too sure that the distinctions are that difficult to actually start making. Just in the same way as we had a situation before the ECT Act where a person hacking into a computer, there was just no crime that we had to prevent a person hacking into a computer. You know, there were all sorts of things, but it's a trespass. But in our law, a trespass, you have to physically be in that place. So I think it is worth considering this issue. One of the areas that I think we should look at as well is the question of children's information. And I'll tell you why. We make the distinction, for instance, between pornography and children's pornography. The one is criminal, the other one is not. And I think when we talk about children's information, we do have the provisions relating to parental consent, etc. But the abuse of children's information is an issue which is already very, very much a problem. But the collection of information about children and then profiling children from that young age until they are much older is another problem that we are seeing constantly. And the issue then of actually selling or processing that information without proper consent, I also believe, needs to be considered from a criminal perspective without necessarily going through the regulator.
What kind of information are you talking about of children?
Personal information of children generally. I'm not talking about purely banking information or anything like that, but the protection of children. One of the issues that we have is that children are online probably far more than their parents. They are providing information very often unwittingly and not understanding the consequences of the provision of that information. And I believe that in those circumstances, the criminalization of the collection of that information would enable us to start dealing with some of the abuses that are clearly are happening in that area already.
Have it as wide as collection, not just sale. Banking,
collection without parental consent, yes.
Okay. Mario, then Ananda.
Yes. A great deal of these discussions we're having, I think, are bedeviled by generalities and really, the many devils are all in these details that we are trying to tease out. To me, there is always the flip side to this discussion, which is the scope of application. Because when we're dealing with with big company, we all agree when we're dealing with you and I, we don't. The fact is that you're giving out your banking details each and every time you give a check. Your check has got all the information which I regard as banking details. Bank, branch number, account number, and your name. So anyone any business receiving a large number of a very large number of checks could be, or any person receiving checks would be liable to pass them onto somebody else. And if that action is illegal, even though the passing on is done without the criminal intent that Hank is referring to, the consequences of the passing on will be landed with the person who breaches the duty of confidentiality. This is the thing. Somebody passes on the information knowing that the recipient will commit a crime. The situation is already dealt with now. If one passes on the information without the intention and good faith, but it breaches the legal obligations under the Act, it's landed with the consequences. And again, the scope of application. Identifying things for children, I don't know, perhaps my child is not old enough, and the definition of children goes all the way to 18, but I cannot think of any aspect of personal information which is related to children would be more significant, in greater need of legal protection than is relating to somebody else. I cannot think of anything which would be more personal and greater need of being protected, versus medical condition, but that applies to all of us. And the fact is that the pain of a breach of an interference in privacy can come from anything, because it depends on what the circumstances is. Medical records can be very, very sensitive. Sexual habits, much more than banking details, or consumer preferences, gambling addictions, drinking addictions.
The unlawful obtaining, etc., of personal data. Section 55, it's page 42 of 129. A person must not knowingly or recklessly, without the consent of the data controller, obtain or disclose personal data or the information contained in personal data, or procure the disclosure to another person of the information contained in personal data. Sub 1 does not apply to a person who shows that the obtaining, disclosing, or procuring was necessary for the purpose of preventing crime, was required or authorized by or under any enactment, under any rule of law, order of court. B, that he acted in the reasonable belief that he had in law the right to obtain or disclose the data or information, or, as the case may be, to procure the disclosure to the other person. C, that he acted in the reasonable belief that he would have had the consent of the data controller if the data controller had known of the obtaining, etc. That in the particular circumstances, the obtaining, disclosing, or procuring was justified as being in the public interest. A person who contravenes sub 1, guilty of an offence. A person who sells personal data is guilty of an offence if he has obtained the data in contravention of sub 1. A person who offers to sell personal data is guilty of an offence if he has obtained the data in contravention at some point. B, he subsequently obtains the data in contravention of. For the purposes of sub 5, an advertisement indicating that personal data are or may be for sale is an offer to sell the data. Okay, and so on. There's a little bit more.
That's clearly creating an offense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's specifically unlawfulness, and then it specifies guilty of an offense. But it's a wider wording of an offence. Ananda? Did you look at the issue of specific offences?
Yes, we did. I actually wanted also to refer to this before I bring up it off my hand, but what I just want to add here is that this is now, we must just think about it carefully, because this is now the case where a person is knowingly or recklessly did this. And mostly, if you think of banking details, I think that it's not really that the bank knowingly and recklessly sell the information or whatever. It's mostly where they the information gets lost or whatever. There's some sort of other problem with it. So I wouldn't really just want to confine it to banking details. I think this would more be applicable to, for instance, direct marketers who sell the lists of personal information.
No, but I think that's what happens.
I think
it's direct marketers selling banking and
cell
phone accounts.
What I wanted to, if I can just say what we did consider while drafting the bill is really in Section 94 with the civil action is the aggravated damages. And that was really the idea where the problem has been so, where a person has been so reckless or so knowingly doing this, then you could add that, which is really something new, which other people don't usually do. It's really for not only for patrimonial, non-patrimonial loss, but actually what they used to call punitive damages, which is really the criminal element. But since it's a criminal element doesn't fit into the civil action, they now call it aggravated damages, and then it has a different meaning. But that is where we try to address this problem. So, but what I was thinking is if one wants to take something like 55, I wouldn't confine it to banking details. I would use 55 as they have it in UK. But maybe look at the New Zealand Act where they actually say provisions, it must, you must knowingly or whatever obtain or disclose the information, but then it must also be, it must also cause or may cause loss, detriment, damage or injury to the person or adversely affect the rights, benefits, privileges or result in significant humiliation, significant loss of dignity, significant injuries or feelings to that person. So it makes it a little bit stricter in the sense that it's not only where you have knowingly, recklessly done whatever you've done, but it has also caused all of these loss, adversely affected or humiliation or whatever. So it's actually in a very sort of, it will then make it sort of the exception, but where that has really happened, in order to address maybe the problems that people may have of saying that, you know, you are getting, the balance is not there. I don't know.
Yeah, just before Hank. I mean, I would have gone specifically for banking details rather than special confirmations. Oh no, not business. Special confirmations. The Amazon double click because if you, well, look, let's take this banking at the moment. Not cell phones, that you can inadvertently make a mistake. The area could be grey. But the problem then, if you're contracting with a party that's overseas, not in this country, and they've got your bank account and they're able to quickly debit it, I mean, there's no remedy for you. So I would want to rather look at protecting bank account details specifically. I'm not against this broader clause as in the UK or New Zealand. However, I do have some sympathy for the direct marketers in terms of selling accessible information that is already in the public domain. Okay, so I'm not wanting to personally, I wouldn't be in favor of shutting down the direct marketers. So I think these things could be looked at, and I agree that maybe it should be a question of harm. But I think where we've got to, the issue of increasing the civil actions, to me, is not a remedy, because it's invariably often people who can't afford to litigate, people who can't afford lawyers, people who are not necessarily so educated, who get themselves taken advantage of in these situations. So I would like, on the bank account thing specifically, to criminalize it. Whether it's only the sale, or whether it's somewhat wider, whether it's as wide as this clause in the UK legislation. I don't know if we can take it much further now. Okay, Hink had a light bulb, yeah, sorry.
I'll rather wait until we've brought the draft for you.
Okay, because what I was then going to say is look, can't you look at it, Ananda, you didn't really look at this with the Law Commission, the criminalisation.
No, we didn't look at the criminal, because that was not really the focus of the bill, in the sense that we were looking at proactive things rather than crime. You know, we did not look at criminalizing the issues at all. So it is something, you know, I'm a bit worried, and I would like to do a little bit more research on that because of also consultation problems.
Hink?
Maybe I should just mention at this stage, and I know my colleague well. I would prefer to go for the first option when we create a crime, and not to draw it through to damage as an element of that crime. There's a specific reason for that, but I would prefer us just doing the simple UK-like clause at this stage.
Can we leave it like this? That you would look at international comparisons. I mean, we've found two already in data protection or personal protection information, New Zealand and the UK. We don't want to have unforeseen consequences with the direct marketers. So we don't want it so wide that it criminalizes things that we didn't intend criminalizing. The issue has been raised specifically of banking detail or the sale of banking accounts, which to my mind is clear cut. Mark has raised the thing which I haven't thought about enough of information relating to children. But can you look at international comparisons? Can you look at then coming up with some options? So it would be specific offences. So the UK one is still quite broad. My fear with the UK one is maybe it's too broad in our situation. That's why I was thinking of specific crimes where there can be no unforeseen consequences. Children, my worry, maybe one is throwing the net so wide that there are unforeseen. I've got Mario then Christine.
Mr. Chairman, again, for purpose of clarity of what it is that we're talking about, because we're dealing with the issue of selling of information, what we have before us is the Wealth Structure Act, which deals with a set of parameters on how to deal with information, to keep it private, so that what is private remains private. How you keep it, how you classify, who is in charge, it, how you update it, etc., etc. The breach of any of these obligations as it relates to banking information may cause the information to go into somebody else's hand. got a small business. We receive checks. We don't keep those checks the way the bill requires us to keep it. We don't keep the information out of those checks that we keep in the computer for all the electronic payments the way we should. My secretary gives those checks to somebody else, one check number, two check numbers, to somebody else, for what is a benign purpose. I've broken the act. There is no intent on her side, but I've broken the act. The recipient utilizes for purposes which are criminal. They take money from the accounts. My secretary and I have committed a crime because we bear the, having conducted an activity which is illegal, we bear the consequences. So let's make sure that if we are on top of this, criminalizing the very leakage of information, we do it only specifically to the intentional sale of information, not just the the breach of any of the other, many of the obligations relating on how you properly deal, maintain, and keep custody of the information.
I think this is probably covered by the Act or the Bill anyway, but I was thinking in the UK where they had those 25 million records that were lost. I mean, somebody was grossly negligent in 9 hours. So, I mean, you might not want to just limit it to the sale. You might want to look at the UK where you just knowing the record information.
I don't know if we can take it much further than that. I think it's all important to talk about clarity and what we want to talk to say about the new areas we have to set
clarify. There's a New Zealand example that I gave. They have that for all their breaches, so not only for this specific. I mean, that's just part of the ordinary book.
Okay.
That's as far as specific offences.
Sorry, I have it. I can give you the New Zealand Act, but I just have it in a footnote here. It says the action has caused or may cause loss, detriment, damage, or injury to that person, or adversely affect or may adversely affect the rights, benefits, privileges, obligations, or interests of that person, or result in or may result in significant humiliation, significant loss of dignity, or significant injury to feelings of that person. So that's just a general.
And how has that act been? How has that offence been applied? I mean, my problem is it's incredibly wide. And is it so wide that it's unenforceable?
That's what I mean. It's not a part of the offence. That is just part of the, before there's a breach of before there's an interference of with the privacy of a person. You have to you breach an information privacy principle and the you cause loss whatever. So they're stricter before the act comes into effect. They have a stricter.
That's not as far as it's not creating crimes.
They have the same rules that we have here. You know, same sort of structure, but it's just that they have a stricter.
You're not particularly applicable then, because we're talking about creating criminal conduct. Okay, are you then clear then on we do want to investigate this issue of specific crimes further? You'd look at international comparisons, you'd look specifically at the banking issue, possible sale, you'd look at the other issue that was raised of information relating to children. You'd look particularly at the UK model, and you'd come up with, you can come up with a range of options or whatever. It's after one, so I'd like to break, 1:10, I'd like to break for lunch. I think then what we can do when we come back, and if we can come back at 2, I think that's 50 minutes is enough time, is then start going through clause by clause till 2 o'clock. Where is lunch? In Old Assembly Dining Room.